for argument this morning is United States against King. Ms. Bierma.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Erica Bierma, and I'm appearing on behalf of the appellant, Brian Underwood. This case presents two simple issues of whether the district court erred in sentencing Mr. Underwood to 120 months and whether the district court clearly erred, implying a two-level firearm enhancement to Mr. Underwood. In looking at Mr. Underwood's sentence, taking the 3553A factors into account, it appears as though the district court applied the sentencing guidelines as mandatory. The district court made very limited discussion as it relates to Mr. Underwood's history and characteristics, promoting respect for the law, and determining an appropriate sentence for Mr. Underwood. All that the district court had said about Mr. Underwood is that he was responsible for approximately 268 grams of methamphetamine, and that he was cooking the methamphetamine to feed he and Ms. King's addictions, and that anything that the district court said about Mr. Underwood could be equally applied to Ms. King, that they were addicts, that they did, both of them left the children in squalor, that they both neglected the children. And looking at the what the district court found in pronouncing his sentence, she merely said that Mr. Underwood comes from a mother who has significant problems and that he began using methamphetamine at a young age, and then pronounced a 120-month sentence. It is this court's position that the district court doesn't have to apply the 3553A factors in a checklist fashion, but I believe that in the district court's findings, that the district court didn't make any findings or didn't articulate any reason to get to the 120-month sentence. The district court also didn't consider Mr. Underwood's lack of criminal history, his substantive employment history. None of that was considered at the time of sentencing. That Ms. King and Mr. Underwood were living together at the time of the offense, that the offense involved manufacturing methamphetamine for their own use. There's no evidence to support that they were distributing any methamphetamine. In fact, the district court found that they weren't distributing methamphetamine. It was merely for their own use. And looking at the district court concluding that Mr. Underwood was responsible for received a two-level enhancement for the firearm, I would respectfully submit that the district court clearly erred. The firearm enhancement was applied under 2D1.11, which says that it's got to be clearly improbable that it's connected with the offense. In looking at the case law, it references back to 2D1.1, which provides that for drug traffickers, that the firearm enhancement applies. Well, and as argued in the district court, Mr. Underwood and Ms. King are not drug traffickers. They're drug users themselves, and it was for possession only. The district court found that the manufacturing was for their own use. There's no evidence of sale. The gun was purchased prior to the manufacturing activities, that Mr. Underwood had lawfully possessed or lawfully purchased the firearm at Gander Mountain a year before the manufacturing activities had commenced. Because they're not distributing, there's no need to protect any money or any kind of stash or anything like that in the house, because there's no one coming and going like in typical distribution type offenses.
Does the fact that there's a 12-year-old or, I guess, 9-year-old living there, did that have any impact one way or the other?
It did on the district court, but the district court applied the firearm to Mr. Underwood and not to Ms. King, and they were residing in the house together. And the only person that was alleged to have seen it was a report by a police officer. And the 9-year-old said that at some point in time that he had seen a firearm, but he didn't give any context as to time or anything like that.
Who saw him brandishing it? Neighbor?
There's some person somewhere that allegedly reported to a Santa Fe police officer that Mr. Underwood had said, don't come near the garage. But that wasn't substantiated or corroborated by anybody else. And if the court has no further questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Counsel? Mr. Ruth.
Yes, sir. Thank you. May I please the court? My name is Rob Ruth. Good morning, gentlemen. There are three basic points that I'd like to make. First of all, you have to read Volt, U.S. versus Volt. That case, that's what this case, that answers the questions in this case. This court has, to a certain extent, spilled into a strict liability.
It may indeed answer the question, but I don't see why it doesn't answer the question adversely to your client. The basis for the decision in Voss was the conclusion that the defendant did not know that the other party had a gun.
Involved.
The judge found here that everybody knew about the gun.
Right, but the district, they knew about the gun. Ms. King knew about the gun, but she didn't. There's no evidence that she saw the gun or heard anything about the gun during the course of the conspiracy, during the course of the manufacture. And so what you're saying is, look, if you know that a person owns a gun, like Ms. King did, then that's it. It's strict liability. You have to assume then that it was reasonably foreseeable that it would be used in this very small-scale, non-distribution manufacturing process. So she knew about the gun. She hadn't seen it for a while. And there's nothing that she knew that for her to connect that gun to this particular operation. So when we're talking about gangs, this court has said, look, you're in a gang, you know how gangs operate. If you know the person has a gun, that's it. You're responsible for the gun if you're a co-conspirator. But when you're not talking about a gang, when you're talking about a gun that was purchased for innocent use, and you're talking about a person who hasn't seen the gun during the course of the conspiracy, there's no reason for Ms. King to connect that gun to this particular conspiracy. And, you know, Judge, or Your Honors, we have the district court, in her own language, seems to support my contention. She says, look it, you knew that there was a gun, and you knew that it was reasonably possible that it could have been used. Well, that's not the standard. And the government must pick up on that, too, because in its response brief, the government says, changes the word could to would, that it was reasonably foreseeable that it would be used. Well, that's the right standard, reasonably foreseeable that it would be used. But that's not what the district court found. She found that it was reasonably foreseeable that it could be used. Well, so what? I mean, that's strict liability. That's strict liability when you say, because there is a gun and it could be used, well, the kitchen knife could be used. You have to have, if you're going to get past strict liability, you have to have some piece of evidence that pushes a person from concluding that it could be used to that it would be used. And we don't have that in this case. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ruth. Mr. Reinhart.
Good morning. David Reinhart for the United States. I guess I'll start with Mr. Underwood's arguments. First of all, one doesn't have to traffic in drugs to get the dangerous weapon enhancement under 2D1.11. Underwood erroneously cites the 2D1.1 application note 3. The applicable guideline section in this case is 2D1.11. In 2D1.11 and its application notes, they do not require the defendant traffic in drugs in order to get the dangerous weapon enhancement. And the reason is because 2D1.11 specifically pertains to those who possess precursor chemicals with the intent to manufacture a controlled substance. It doesn't deal with drug dealing or possession with intent to distribute drugs. Next, the district court did not commit clear error in applying the dangerous weapon enhancement. The .45 caliber pistol was found hanging from a light fixture inside the home at the top of the stairwell. It was loaded. It wasn't secured away. It was accessible. Underwood threatened his neighbor with the firearm when the neighbor peered into the garage where the meth lab was located. Underwood is the only person in this case that indicates that the gun was normally kept in a safe in the basement, and that's his self-serving statement made before sentencing. It's just a heck of a coincidence that on the day police execute a search warrant, here's a gun hanging from a light fixture, that he just happened to clean it on that day, and that he just, heck of a coincidence, that he just happened to load that particular firearm. As far as the sentence, I just don't know how Underwood can say that the court applied the guidelines in a mandatory fashion. There's absolutely no support for that in the record. Judge Krepp stated on the record that she was taking into consideration both the advisory guideline range and the 3553A factors. Then she actually went through the 3553A factors, the serious nature of the offense, the fact that this activity jeopardized the lives of the children, the horrible conditions the children were exposed to, the quantity of precursor drugs. And
how many
she
children
also,
were there? How many children
what's that?
Were there? How many children were there?
There were two children in the house, a 3-year-old and a 9-year-old. She also talked about the history and characteristics of the defendant. The fact that she read the letters of support for him, his difficult childhood, and that also she went over a mitigating factor that they weren't dealing the drugs, that it appeared that they were just feeding their own addiction. So if the judge just felt, in weighing all the circumstances of this case, that the middle of the guidelines was the appropriate sentence. In looking to Holly King and her argument regarding the dangerous weapon enhancement, I think the bottom line in this particular case is the district court unequivocally stated that it would give the same sentence whether the dangerous weapon enhancement applied or not. First, the district court stated that the gun enhancement probably wouldn't affect the final sentence, but that wasn't the only the court's only reference, as suggested by counsel in his reply brief. On page 17 of the transcript, and 42 of the defendant's own appendix, the district court stated, "This is the same sentence I would give whether the drug enhancement or gun enhancement applied or not," and sentenced the defendant to below the guideline range. Ultimately sentenced the defendant to the guideline range without the enhancement. So I just can't see where they have an argument in regards to that particular issue. And as far as Vold is distinguishable from this case, there's no evidence Vold ever saw or heard anything about the firearm. The gun was found in Vold's co-conspirator's home. In this particular case, King admitted that she was aware that there was a firearm around, and the gun was found in her home hanging from a light fixture. And the standard, even if there are two permissible views of the evidence, the fact finder's choice between them cannot be clear error. If there aren't any further questions, I would ask this court to affirm the district court's decision.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Ms. Bierman?
Just a few quick points, Your Honor. As Mr. Ruth states, Ms. King said she hadn't seen the firearm and that it was in no connection with the criminal activity. The firearm was not connected with the manufacturing activities. The firearm was located, like Mr. Reinhardt said, hanging from a light fixture in the basement of the house, which the manufacturing activities were taking place in the garage. Mr. Underwood challenged at the time of sentencing who this person was, and the government never produced who this was and disputed that it was a neighbor, someone reported the information to the Sun Prairie Police Department, who in turn provided that information to Ben Poller. And Ben Poller, who is the special agent, is the only person that said that Mr. Underwood threatened anyone with the firearm. The manufacturing activities completely occurred in the garage. There's no evidence to support that anything was going on in the house. Mr. Underwood argued at the time of sentencing that the firearm had been out for cleaning, and it's my recollection that there's only one bullet in the chamber. And as it relates to the sentence, Ms. King and Mr. Underwood could be interchangeable as it relates to the kids, the offense conduct. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Ruth, anything further?
Yes, just two quick points. The question about
whether it the judge saying, well, it probably wouldn't affect the sentence, and then apparently he pointed out that at one point she said, I would give the same sentence. I had forgotten about that. The fact of the matter is the standard is the judge has to properly apply the guidelines. And if she improperly applied the guidelines, you have to reverse. All of the cases that the government cites are non-guideline cases for the proposition that, well, you shouldn't reverse if you would get the same sentence. It makes a difference beyond just the guidelines and the sentence. The prison treats you differently if you have a weapon enhancement. So it makes a difference in this particular case either way. Also, as far as Vold, knowing that there's possession is not enough. It has to be that you know that the possession of the gun is in furtherance of the criminal activity. That's why it's so important that there be a finding that Ms. King knew that the gun was in connection with the underlying criminal activity, and we don't have that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ruth, and we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case. The case is taken under advisement.